today's CLUIN seminar. Today's session will look at tenant liability considerations for siting renewable energy on contaminated land and has been co-sponsored by the EPA's Offices of Solid Waste as well as the Office of Enforcement and Compliance Assurance. My name is Jean Balance, and I'm the moderator for today's online event coming to you from EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division. Before we begin the technical portion of the broadcast today, I'm going to cover a few reminders and housekeeping items. For those of you who are just hopping on the line, welcome. We're going to go past our starting slide, the title slide, and move on to, again, those housekeeping rules. Our entire seminar today is going to be broadcast online via a new meeting tool, Adobe Connect. When you registered for today's seminar, you would have been directed to the seminar homepage, which had a complete description of the event, links to download the presentation materials, contact and bios for our presenters as well as myself. On that seminar homepage, there's a button that appears on the left-hand side that actually prompts you to go to the seminar. If you click that button, you can actually check in online and join us for the online broadcast. And I would encourage everyone to take those steps now if you haven't, so that you can get the full experience for our session today. If you have simply downloaded the materials, again, you may miss out on some of the live components of the broadcast, so I would encourage you to go ahead and try to check in online and join us through Adobe. By default, all audio is being streamed online for our participants, so everybody should be able to hear me through their computer speakers or mobile devices. If you're having any problems with that online audio stream, the first thing I would encourage you to do is to check your own local volume settings. You may find that you need to increase your speaker volume, go into the sound control on your computer, actually boost the audio output. Some participants find wearing a pair of headphones can help drastically improve the audio quality. If you continue to have any problems with the online audio, please feel free to use the Q&A window, which appears on the right side of the lower portion of your screen, to type a message or comment into me, and I'll be happy to share call-in information. We do have telephone lines available that have been globally muted, and we would ask that all participants who are joining us on the phone lines remain on that global mute to help cut down on background noises or disruptions. Again, I'll show a screenshot of what the interface looks like in a moment, but everybody should see three windows in front of them today. The main portion on the left-hand side of your screen actually shows the slide. I'm on slide number two, the housekeeping slide. And then to the right of that, you'll see two windows, one being the related URL in the upper right, and then the Q&A window in the lower right. You actually already have a welcome message from me in that window. Questions were previously collected and submitted for today's seminar, and so those pre-submitted questions will be addressed during today's live broadcast. If you have future questions or questions beyond what we're going to address today, you're encouraged to actually submit them to the presenters following the live delivery, and we'll share their contact information again before we close out today. You'll find their contact information on the seminar homepage, which I'll point everybody to before we close. If you like the training you're seeing today, you want to participate in something like this in the future, or you want to take a look at some of our archive sessions, we do have nearly 500 recorded seminars already available for free replay on the CLUIN website. So again, just a quick reminder for the screen. This is just a rough schematic of what you're looking at. You'll be able to watch the slides in real time. Each participant can actually press a button that says full screen. It appears in the upper right corner of the slides, and that'll actually locally increase or maximize the slides. If you want to get out of that view and bring it back to the normal environment, simply press the full screen button again, and it'll collapse them back down to the normal size. You'll see a collection of related URLs here. I'd encourage you to browse those and take a look at them. Any one of you can press on one of the URLs and then click the Browse To button to locally pull them up on your own end. And then lastly, and most importantly, that Q&A window in the lower right corner, you can privately submit your comments or any technical issues you might be encountering here and press the little cartoon bubble to submit them to us on the back end. I think that's the end of the reminders that I have for today's session. I think we're ready to go ahead and gear up for today's live broadcast. Again, we do have a number of presenters who will be joining us, and our first is Katie Brown, who is a AAAS Science and Technology Policy Fellow, who's being hosted by the U.S. EPA. She's currently serving, again, in the EPA's Repowering America's Land Initiative and has worked in solar energy for over 12 years, first as a researcher and a technical monitor at NERL, and then most recently as a program manager in product development in the solar energy industry. Katie received her MS in Engineering and Technology Management and a BS in Engineering Physics from the Colorado School of Mines. Next, we'll be joined by Susan Bouchel, who is an attorney advisor here at EPA. And Susan has been working in the EPA's Office of Site Remediation Enforcement for over 10 years. Since 2002, she's been working on liability issues that arise in the agency's implementation of the Brownfield Amendments to CERCLA. She started her career in private practice in D.C., working on hazardous waste management and chemical regulation issues. Susan received her JD from the National Law Center at George Washington University and a BS in Chemistry from the University of Maryland, College Park. Our third speaker today will be Hollis Luzecki, who's an attorney advisor here at EPA, and she actually is part of the Superfund Enforcement Group. As part of the headquarters Brownfields Revitalization Team, Hollis has worked on Brownfields liability issues and settlement agreements. She's currently the contact for comfort status letters and also works on the contiguous property owner and contaminated aquifer issues. As a member of the Environmentally Responsible Redevelopment and Reuse, or ER3 team, Hollis has helped facilitate environmentally responsible redevelopment through the use of enforcement tools. She received her JD from Drake Law School and a BA in International Relations and Environmental Science from the University of Minnesota. So I'll go ahead and turn things over to our presenters, again, starting out for today's internet seminar looking at the Repowering America's Land Initiative, specifically tenant liability considerations for siting renewable energy on contaminated properties.
Thank you, Jean. This is Katie. I'd like to welcome all of the participants back to the Repowering America's Land Initiative webinar series. Today's webinar is on tenant liability considerations for siting renewable energy on contaminated lands. Today we will be providing a brief overview of the Repowering America's Land Initiative, and then I'll be handing it off to Susan Bouchel to cover the 2012 updated tenants guidance, followed by Hollis Luzecki, who will cover the model comfort and status letters for the Repowering program itself, as well as introduce you to a series of tools and resources associated with our project. For those of you not familiar with the Repowering America's Land Initiative, it was initiated in 2008 in order to encourage renewable energy development on current and formerly contaminated lands, landfills, and mine sites, especially when aligned with the community's vision for the site. Our technology portfolio includes wind, solar, geothermal, and biomass. These sites offer a unique value proposition to both developers and communities. There are potential benefits associated with reuse of contaminated lands for renewable energy deployment. From the developer's perspective, they're now able to offer an option to build a sustainable land development strategy based on over 15 million acres of contaminated lands that the EPA is currently tracking, and that helps to protect existing open space. In addition, you're able to gain community support, not only through providing low-cost, clean power to these communities, but also through the revitalizing sites that may have been a blight in their neighborhoods. There's also potential economic benefits through leveraging existing infrastructure, reduced land costs, and taking advantage of tax incentives, as well as reduced project cycle times. We are seeing a growing trend of renewable energy development on contaminated land, landfills, and mine sites. And here you see a subset of those projects looking coast to coast. So we've got projects that we know of in 25 states. And here's just a smattering. And you'll see that predominantly there are large numbers of solar developments on contaminated lands and a few wind projects, as well as a couple biomass. To date, we know of approximately 60 projects based on publicly available information, including press releases and other announcement materials. To date, we know of 185 megawatts of renewable energy installations on contaminated sites. And here you'll see the top 10 states by installed capacity, followed by the rest of the U.S. Numbers. But I think it's a great example of how this is a growing trend in renewables and something that we're working to support. So understanding that market, we know as an agency that renewable energy, specifically those developments, tend to be associated with ground leases. And in that way, the tenant liability considerations are important because EPA sees return of contaminated lands to productive reuse is a primary priority for our agency, and we understand that renewables are a productive and viable reuse for these lands. We have been working with the Office of Enforcement and Compliance Assurance in order to further enable this reuse. So I'll turn it over to Susan to talk through what we did on the tenants' guidance.
Thanks, Jean, and thanks, Katie. As Katie mentioned, we're going to briefly discuss the issue of Superfund liability and enforcement in the context of renewable energy projects, since concerns about potential Superfund liability often arise when a party is looking to reuse a contaminated or formerly contaminated property. First, though, I wanted to provide a brief overview of the Federal Liability and Enforcement Program. Many of you may be familiar with it, but just in case you're not, there are two principal laws that work together to address the handling, disposal, and cleanup of hazardous waste. These are commonly referred to as CERCLA and RCRA. The longer names of each of these statutes are listed here on the slide. Today we'll be focusing, though, particularly on CERCLA, which is commonly referred to as Superfund. And it's also important to note that this is the federal program that we're focused on, but the states have their own Superfund-type laws as well. And under the federal statute, under CERCLA, EPA does have broad legal authority to require cleanups of contaminated properties when it's necessary to protect public health or the environment. CERCLA is premised on the principle that it's the polluter who should pay, not the taxpayer, for the cleanup of contamination on a property. So building on this principle, the agency's taken what we call an enforcement-first approach to getting properties cleaned up. That really means what we're first going to try to do is to get the responsible party to either perform or to pay for the cleanup before the agency pays out of its own pocket to get it cleaned up. And this approach is very important in this time of shrinking federal budgets. But while we have an enforcement-first approach, enforcement is not meant to discourage the development of contaminated properties. To the contrary, the agency recognizes the benefits of the reuse of contaminated property because it really provides a powerful incentive to encourage cleanups more quickly. It helps the agency achieve its own cleanup and enforcement goals. We're saving federal and state cleanup resources, and of course, we're protecting the environment. So while we're doing all this, we really strive to find the right balance between the enforcement-first approach and site reuse goals. And the enforcement program is eager to see reuse of contaminated properties, which involve plans and practices that reduce the environmental impacts of cleanups and reuse. Such as what Katie's discussed, this includes the renewable energy development approaches. It's important to recognize first that most properties are not subject to federal cleanup activities. Federal cleanups are usually the last resort, and since many federal agencies have limited resources, attention is focused on the worst sites first. So when we talk about sites that are of actual federal interest and subject to federal cleanup actions, we're really talking about sites that are on the Superfund National Priorities List, or the NPL, sites that are subject to other types of CERCLA cleanup activities, such as removal actions, facilities being addressed through RCRA corrective action, and the other sites listed on this slide. And so what this really means is that the vast majority of cleanups of contaminated properties are dealt with at the state level, not the federal level, and these are typically handled through state voluntary cleanup programs. At sites of federal interest, the parties who may be potentially liable for the cleanup of the property are listed here. Real quickly, there's the party who currently owns or operates the property, any former owner-operator when hazardous substances were disposed. Parties we typically call the generator or arranger, those are the parties who arrange for disposal of hazardous substances, or the transporter of hazardous substances to the property and was involved in the selection of the facility. As you can guess, it's this first category, the current owner and operator, that comes into play most often when we're contacted about liability issues in the reuse context. It's worth noting that it's the courts, though, not EPA or state agencies, who are vested with the ultimate authority to determine the liability of a party. And the case law construing liability is not always settled. So while the agency tries to help parties address their liability concerns and questions, we can't always give hard and fast answers. So while we have these broad categories of liable parties, CERCLA also provides liability protection to certain types of parties. And several of these statutory protections were added in 2002 as part of the commonly called Brownfield Amendment. So you often hear them discussed in the context of the Brownfield Amendment. And similarly, many states have provided liability protections along these lines at the state level, too. So most notably, the protections, the statutory protections include the bona fide prospective purchaser, or BFPP protection, the contiguous property owner, and the innocent landowner protections as well. And there are also additional protections in the statute, not listed here, which include the lender liability or secured creditor exemption, and one addressing involuntary acquisitions by state and local governments. And the list is goes on, but these are the ones that we're going to discuss today. One of the questions received in advance was whether these protections apply at a RCRA corrective action site. These federal protections are not property specific, meaning they provide protection from federal Superfund liability at any contaminated property, regardless of whether it's one of the sites I mentioned a moment ago or sites not even on our radar screen. And they apply regardless of whether the reuse is for renewable energy development or a shopping mall or any other type of development project. But it's really important to remember that these are a protection under CERCLA, meaning they protect only against liability under CERCLA, and they do not protect a party from RCRA liability, which unfortunately doesn't have similar protections in the statute, or other types of liability, such as state liability. And as you'll continue to hear throughout this presentation, Congress really intended for these protections to be self-implementing. They really meant for EPA not to be a necessary party or involved in these transactions, and EPA won't be involved, and it won't be appropriate for EPA to be involved in the vast majority of contaminated property transactions. The bona fide prospective purchaser protection, or the BFP protection, is the most commonly applicable protection, since it allows a purchaser to acquire the property with knowledge of the contamination. And as we'll discuss shortly, it applies in some instances to tenants. There are a number of threshold criteria and continuing obligations that a purchaser must meet for the protection to apply. Perhaps most notably, all appropriate inquiry, or AAI, must be performed before the property is acquired. The purchaser must use reasonable steps when encountering hazardous substances on the property, and the list goes on here on the slide. EPA has issued several guidance documents to assist our personnel in making enforcement decisions about the use of this protection or the applicability of this protection at a particular site. These guidance documents are available on our website, which is identified at the end of this presentation. And so they're available if you would like to do any further reading on any of these topics. These include the Common Elements Guidance, which was issued in 2003, the Affiliation Guidance issued in 2011, and as we'll be discussing shortly, the Tenants Guidances that were issued in 2009 and 2012. Since many property transactions often involve lease arrangements, not just simply purchases, we often hear concerns and receive questions regarding liability for tenants under CERCLA. First and foremost, we'd like to emphasize that not all leases and the mere execution of a lease does not necessarily give rise to CERCLA liability at a property. However, in recognition of the potential liability of some tenants, the BFPP protection did include a specific reference to tenants. The inclusion of tenants in the provision triggered a lot of questions regarding the applicability of the BFPP provision and EPA's treatment of tenants. And you'll have to wait 1 second. I'm having technical difficulties, unfortunately. If somebody else on the line, I've lost my connection with the presentation.
If somebody can just let us know when you're on the page.
Sure. I'm on EPA guidance on the treatment of tenants. So to assist EPA regional staff with making enforcement decisions on a site-specific basis, EPA has developed enforcement guidance regarding tenants and the BFPP provision. The first was issued in 2009, and as we'll discuss, we issued revised guidance this past December. You could turn the slide.
Okay.
EPA's enforcement discretion. First, I want to mention that our guidance documents typically include the words enforcement discretion throughout them. And these words are really intended to make clear that the guidance is intended to be used by regional staff in making enforcement decisions at a particular site. Of course, we recognize that stakeholders also look to our guidance for information as well. So it's also to make sure that everyone understands that an enforcement discretion guidance is not the same as a statutory protection. This means that it doesn't prevent one party at the site from pursuing another party at that site. Next slide, please. So let's quickly delve into the tenants guidance EPA has issued. EPA's first guidance was issued in 2009, and it basically addressed two categories of tenants. The first category included those tenants who might be considered to be an owner at a property based on their lease arrangement and their activities at the property. These tenants often are referred to as having indicia of ownership or being de facto owners at the property. The second category focused on tenants facing liability who weren't de facto owners under their lease arrangement. They truly were just operating on the property. The 2009 guidance addressed those operator-type tenants where the owner itself was a BFPP, and which meant that the tenant could derive BFPP status from the owner. So one of the questions we received in advance of the webinar was which tenants were not covered by the 2009 guidance. The answer is the 2009 guidance did not address those tenants where the owner did not qualify as a BFPP. And in most instances, that meant the owner was a PRP, a potentially responsible party. And so this is a great segue as we fast forward to 2012. And through the agency's repowering initiative, parties involved in renewable energy projects raised concerns to the agency about the fact that this category of parties, those where the owner is a PRP and doesn't qualify as a BFPP, were not addressed by that 2009 guidance. So as a result, the agency decided to revisit the 2009 guidance, and when we did, it led to the revised guidance issued last December. And although concerns raised at renewable energy products were the impetus for this revised guidance, we want to note that the 2012 guidance is generic. It applies across all industries, not just the renewable energy industry. And so based on lessons learned in the 2012 guidance, we decided to take a slightly different, more straightforward, arguably, approach when categorizing the types of tenants. So as you'll see on the slide, the guidance similarly uses two categories of tenants, but the categories of tenants have changed, are now broken down into those where the owner of the property is a BFPP and may derive BFPP status, and those where the owner is not. Next slide, please. For that first category tenants, those tenants where the owner is a BFPP, the 2012 guidance, like the 2009 guidance, discusses that they may derive BFPP status from the owner. This means that as long as the owner maintains its BFPP status, meaning they meet the criteria we just discussed a few minutes ago for the BFPP protection, then the tenant does not have an independent duty to carry out those responsibilities. The tenant is covered so long as there are no further disposable hazardous substance, the first bullet listed there, and the tenant doesn't impede any cleanup or restoration activities at the property. So what would happen if the owner loses its BFPP status, but it's not the tenant's fault? If that occurs, the 2012 guidance provides that EPA may exercise its enforcement discretion and treat the tenant as a BFPP if the tenant itself carries out those BFPP responsibilities. Again, we're talking about that list of criteria we just discussed a few minutes ago, such as exercising reasonable steps with respect to the hazardous substances at the property. But the exception here is that the tenant would not need to conduct all appropriate inquiry, since that has already been conducted by the former BFPP owner. Now, having said that, even though the AAI isn't included and the tenant's not required to do AAI, the guidance recognizes that a tenant still may want to go ahead and conduct its own AAAI in order to have all of that info it needs to ensure there are no surprises to jeopardize its own BFPP treatment. Next slide, please. The second category of the 2012 guidance addresses everyone else, those tenants where the owner is not a BFPP. And as we discussed a few moments ago, this represents the real change from the 2009 guidance. If the owner is not a BFPP, the 2012 guidance provides a tenant may still be treated as a BFPP by EPA, and EPA is using its enforcement discretion at that site, if the tenant acts like the BFPP, which means the tenant meets the BFPP criteria listed here. And this is a reiteration for the most part of the criteria we listed before, except because the owner isn't a BFPP, the criteria for this category of tenants includes the performance of AAI before the tenant executes their lease. So for both categories of tenants, though, I need to emphasize once again that this guidance is intended to guide the regions when they're making their enforcement decisions at a particular site. On some occasions, there may be reasons to not treat a tenant as a BFPP. For example, the guidance identifies situations such as where the lease is designed to avoid CERCLA liability, which may warrant that they not be treated as a BFPP under this guidance. Hopefully, of course, those instances will be rare. Next slide, please. So to recap, this guidance is, we believe, to be an important guidance that's going to be relevant at numerous renewable energy projects, which may include landfills, munition response sites, really any contaminated property. The statutory protections that we started the discussion with, including the BFPP protection in 107R1, is self-implementing. So we're hoping that EPA involvement won't be warranted at the vast majority of these sites. But we do recognize that at some sites, EPA may need to get involved to address questions and concerns about liability that have been raised. And so as a result, we're going to spend a little time discussing those concerns. I'll turn it over to Hollis to discuss some of the tools in EPA's toolbox when EPA's involvement is needed at a particular site. Thanks.
Thanks, Susan. Hello, everyone. My name is Hollis Suzuki, and like Susan, I'm an attorney in the Superfund Enforcement Office at headquarters. And I'm going to talk about the model comfort status letters, which can be a great tool at sites with renewable energy potential. So what are some of our enforcement tools? The EPA uses a number of tools that provide varying levels of comfort to prevent actual or perceived liability from hindering the redevelopment of contaminated or formerly contaminated properties and even potentially contaminated sites. In a limited number of cases, the EPA may enter into a legal settlement agreement with a party to provide comfort by resolving their liability. But in the vast majority of cases where EPA involvement is necessary, it's simply enough for EPA to share with the party the information that the EPA has about the property or the site. And EPA shares this information in what we call our comfort status letters. And here, the comfort comes from knowing what EPA knows about the property or the site and what this information means. As such, the letters provide the status with regards to contamination, EPA response actions or involvement, and potential resources or tools. There, as Susan has noted, though, there is no need for EPA to be involved in all transactions, and even less so since the 2002 Brownfield Amendments. Congress meant for these new protections to be self-implementing, as Susan noted, and to alleviate these liability concerns and the need for EPA involvement. Therefore, sometimes enforcement's involvement unnecessarily at sites can further perpetuate the perceived need for EPA involvement, potentially creating additional barriers and delays for revitalization. So we'd like to avoid that. So why does EPA use comfort status letters? Well, they're used to facilitate reuse and to mitigate potential stigma associated with Superfund sites. Typically, when appropriate, the letters are much more efficient in an effective manner for EPA to provide comfort to a party rather than a settlement agreement, which can take quite a while to issue. Again, as noted, they should only be used when EPA involvement is critical and not for every property transaction. Under agency policies, the letter should only be issued when there is a realistic perception or probability of Superfund liability and when there's no other mechanism that can address the party's concerns. Again, we don't want to erode the usefulness of these letters or create unnecessary requests for the letters. And it's always within the discretion of the region to determine if a letter is appropriate and they have the resources to issue a comfort letter. The letters help a party to make informed decisions with regards to their purchase, lease, or development of a property, which in the case of renewable energy sites will most likely be a lease. And it provides them with reasonable information about the property. The party is then able to gain a better understanding of EPA's involvement at the property and how it may impact their project or their responsibilities with respect to any contamination or former contamination at the site. The letters can be appropriate for contaminated, formerly contaminated, potentially contaminated sites, such as brownfield sites, CERCLA sites, RCRA sites. So it can be used in any number of situations, not necessarily just renewable energy sites, but here we're focusing on those types of sites. And no matter what kind of site it is, the purpose is the same, to share information that the EPA has about the property. So what information are parties generally looking for, and what do we include in comfort status letters? Again, we include information about the property, what contamination is present, the listing status of a site, investigatory study or cleanup plans that we may have for the site, site progress, whether EPA action is likely at a site or potential state activity or involvement now or in the future, whether it be a CERCLA response action or RCRA action. We can talk about potential applicability of environmental statutes and EPA guidance, such as the tenant guidance that Susan just discussed. Can also talk about obligations and reasonable steps that are necessary at the site and other resources and tools. Now, with regards to reasonable steps, which tend to be a key element of many comfort status letters, EPA can suggest reasonable steps related to stopping continuing releases, preventing threatened releases in the future, preventing or limiting human, environmental, or natural resource exposure to earlier releases. And by suggesting these necessary reasonable steps, a party then knows what actions they need to do, you know, if there's contamination or physical or institutional controls present at a property, and to prevent disturbing or exacerbating this contamination or interfering with any potential EPA response action at a property. Sometimes parties request EPA to go further in letters, but it's really important to understand that the EPA cannot make determinations of liability or give no action assurances in comfort status letters. As Susan noted, it's not within EPA's purview to say whether or not a party is liable or afforded a particular exemption or protection under CERCLA. This is a legal determination made by a court of law. In addition, the EPA has a no-action assurance policy. This means that EPA cannot say in a status letter how it will exercise its enforcement discretion in a particular instance or accommodate requests for forbearance or action involving enforcement-related activities. The EPA can state what statutory provisions most likely apply in a situation and how EPA generally intends to treat parties under enforcement discretion guidance, but it's really up to the party working with their own legal counsel to determine compliance with those provisions or likely application of an EPA guidance to the facts and their specific property. Again, the purpose of a comfort letter is to share information, not provide covenants or liability protections, which are typically done through legal settlement agreements. No action assurances are permitted, but only in very limited circumstances and only with advance approval from the assistant administrator of the enforcement office. And these typically happen, they're very rare. When they do happen, it's typically because of a statutory authority, such as a contiguous property owner, provision which does allow actually for EPA to provide assurances. And the reason that no action assurances are reserved for these very narrow circumstances is because EPA doesn't want to create a real or perceived inequity in how we treat parties. And in addition, a commitment not to enforce a legal requirement could severely hamper a later necessary enforcement effort, regardless of whether the action is against the recipient of the insurance or against a party who claims to be similarly situated. So do comfort letters serve as EPA's approval for a given project? In short, no. EPA can determine that a site's conditions, including restrictions, are protective for general types of uses, but specific land use lies within the jurisdiction of a local government. EPA can't endorse a particular project, but as noted, we support redevelopment as part of our agency's priorities and generally recognize the benefits of sustainably redeveloping sites. And the renewable or the repowering model letters that we've created are geared towards facilitating renewable energy projects in general. And after discussing their plans with EPA and other relevant authorities, it's up to the party consulting again with their own legal counsel and environmental specialist to ensure that a project is compatible either with the law, cleanup, restrictions, ICs, et cetera. Now, EPA has developed three model comfort status letters for use in the most common situations to assist regions with issuing letters and to give the public a sense of what to expect from these letters. There will usually be three types of sites: a site where no EPA involvement has occurred, a site where state action is taking place or the state is the lead for the site, and sites where there was previous or current EPA involvement at a site. The letters contain model language related to the purpose of a comfort status letter, the cleanup programs it might be under, the repowering initiative, BFPP provisions, and EPA guidance. And because the majority, these renewable energy sites do typically deal with tenants, that's why we have BFPP provision language in these letters. And of course, site-specific facts will dictate the exact language of these letters because there may be site-specific reasonable steps or other policies or tools that are relevant to a property. But in general, sticking to the model language will prevent issuing or delays in issuing the letters to a party. Significant deviations from the language in these model letters needs to be approved by headquarters prior to their issuance, so that's why it's generally best to stick with the language in the models. And we have a link to the 1996 comfort status letter policy here, but a caveat with regards to this policy: it was written prior to the Brownfields amendments in 2002, quite, a ways before that, and it was also issued prior to guidance on how no action assurance policy applies to Superfund. So it's somewhat outdated, and our current practice and policy differs slightly from the 96 policy. But these new model letters that we have issued for renewable energy sites incorporates how the agency currently approaches comfort status letters. And in the future, we hope to update this policy to be more consistent with our current practice and how we issue them. So it's fairly simple to determine which model best fits your needs. Here's a general flow chart of distinguishing which letters may be appropriate in your case. And typically, if the site is listed in CERCLIS, then there is some sort of federal or state interest at the site. CERCLIS could designate the site as, and CERCLIS is the agency's inventory of sites that have come to our attention. So if a site is listed in CERCLA's, it's on EPA's radar screen. This doesn't necessarily mean that there will be action at a site, but there is the potential for it. And if the site has been archived from CERCLA's or partially deleted from the NPL or deleted from the NPL, there is no current interest at the site, so a no current federal interest letter may be appropriate in that situation. Again, if it's state lead or being handled under a state voluntary cleanup program, a state action letter may be appropriate. And if it's in CERCLA's and EPA is planning or currently performing action, then the federal interest letter would be appropriate. And if it's not in CERCLA's at all, again, it doesn't necessarily mean that there may not be a problem at the site, but we're not aware of it and it's not on our radar screen. So if any EPA regional folks have any questions about comfort status letters, feel free to call me. My contact information is listed at the end of the presentation. For those people on the phone or joining in on the presentation from the private sector, it's generally best to start with a regional contact if you're interested in a comfort letter or other enforcement tool at your property. They typically have the information related to your specific site or property, unlike a headquarters. So I would start with a regional contact. And now I'll pass it back to Katie to talk about other tools and resources.
Thank you so much, Hollis and Susan, for covering the 2012 guidance as well as the model comfort letters. Under the Repowering Initiative over the past few years, the EPA has released a series of tools and other resources specifically tailored to renewable energy development on contaminated land, landfills, and mine sites. Among those, we've recently released a handbook on siting renewable energy projects while addressing environmental issues. And here we highlight opportunities for siting those projects while addressing the contamination during all phases of cleanup. So as early as the time of early site investigation, identifying the site, screening it for potential, and planning the remediation solution to integrate with the renewable energy projects, as well as a new best practices document for siting solar PV on municipal solid waste landfills. In that, we highlight current best practices unique to siting solar systems on landfills, and cover everything from system design, construction, all the way through operation and maintenance. That document is currently being finalized and will be released in the coming weeks. In addition, we have site screening tools, including a repowering Google Earth overlay that shows all EPA track sites, as well as a subset of the state track sites, so that you're able to get a quick pre-screen on solar, wind, biomass, and geothermal potential at each of the sites. We also have released a series of liability fact sheets and success stories, in addition to this quarterly webinar series that you're on today, with newsletters as well. And on occasion, we have topic-specific workshops that we will also announce through our newsletters and regional offices. As part of the 2012 revised tenants guidance announcement, we coordinated with OECA, the Enforcement and Compliance Assurance Team, to release a repowering specific liabilities considerations fact sheet. Much of the information presented in today's webinar is reiterated on that fact sheet, including what federal laws govern the liability for contaminated properties, who's generally liable for that contamination and cleanup, and whether or not EPA would hold a party liable, especially in the context of a renewable energy projects, what liability protections could be available, whether or not documentation is available to confirm liability protection, and what are the next steps to move forward on a project. And you can find that on the Repowering website as well as the OECA cleanup website. In addition, the Brownfields team has released a handbook on revitalizing contaminated lands, specifically associated with addressing liability concerns. In that document, it's a compilation of enforcement tools, guidance, and policy documents that are available to help promote the cleanup and revitalization of contaminated properties. There's additional tools and resources on the website, but this document is a great start. If you have additional questions for any of us concerning the information presented today, please email us directly. I'm listed information for both the Enforcement and Compliance Assurance Team with Susan Buschel and Hella Suzeki, as well as James Miles, who supported the tenants' guidance development. And then on the right-hand side, there is contact information for the Repowering America's Land Initiative team, including Bridget Lowry and myself, and a link to the Rapid Response team. As part of Repowering America's Land Initiative, we have partnered with individuals in each of the regional offices to serve as immediate responses for site-specific information. So when you go to the site, it will list representatives for each region, listing out each state in each region so that you can identify your contact. Go ahead and email them or myself, and we will work with you to help support and facilitate your project. Thank you for participating in today's webinar, and I will hand it off to Jean to close out.
Great, thank you so very much. So we are coming up at about 1:46 p.m. Eastern. We've gone through the technical portion of the broadcast for today's session, and so we're going to go ahead and start with our closeout procedures for today's seminar. We did have nearly 150 individuals join us from all over the country, and I want to thank everybody who was able to join us live for our online broadcast. Before we close things out, again, I just wanted to remind those of you, if this is your first time participating in a CLUIN webinar, we do offer free online training like this, as well as share other resources, files. We have newsletters. We're constantly trying to share information to the cleanup professional community. So you can visit us at CLUIN, CLUIN.org, or find us on popular social and professional networking sites such as Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. We'd encourage you to stay connected with us to be alerted of the latest sessions as they're made available. When you join today's seminar, again, you would have been directed to that very important seminar homepage. You can find references and links to the seminar homepage on the far upper right corner of your screen. The very top link is the seminar homepage. If you visit the seminar homepage, you'll again find copies of the presentation materials, contact information, and bios for all of our presenters today, as well as a few helpful links, one of them being that additional resources. So all of the URLs that you see on our live online broadcast, those have all been collected and are made available on the additional resources page. So if you go to the seminar homepage and click the links or additional resources button, you'll be able to pull these files up and refer back to them at any time. I'd also encourage you to take just a moment to fill out the short feedback form. Again, that feedback form is on the seminar homepage. You'll also find it up in the related URLs window. It takes just a minute or two to fill that out and just let us know what you thought of the live broadcast today, and we'll be sharing your feedback with our presenters. If you need confirmation of your participation today, we don't necessarily offer CEUs or PDHs for the seminar. But if you're trying to earn credit, I would encourage you to refer back to your seminar registration email. Take a copy of the presentation materials and submit feedback. When you submit feedback, there's an option to actually check a box and have a confirmation message sent to you for your own records. As long as your email address has been entered correctly, you'll at least get a note verifying you submitted feedback after the live delivery. So if you couple that with the registration and materials that were discussed, you may be able to earn credit. If you shared the line with multiple participants, each person can actually get their own feedback submitted as well as get their own confirmation message. Once you fill that form out, there's a link that will appear that will let another person hop on and fill out their own form. And I would encourage you to take advantage of that to give us your feedback. We do thank each and every one of you for taking the time to let us know what you thought of today's session. As soon as an archived version of today's seminar is made available, we'll go through that with our presenters, and then we'll be able to share information on how to access an archived version automatically by email. It usually takes us a few days to about a week or so, so I'd encourage you to keep your eyes peeled for an email with information, again, on how to refer back to an archived version of today's session. I think that's the end of all the reminders that I have for today, except for one final one, and that's, again, if you have follow-up questions. We did share contact information for our presenters. You can find that on the seminar homepage. Just a reminder, I'm going to send a message to everybody. If you have follow-up questions, you can direct them to one of the individuals who will be listed in just a moment on the Q&A window in the lower right corner of your screen. And again, I'm going to pass this on to everybody, and I just want to thank those of you who joined us from all over the United States today. I hope that you found this to be a valuable expenditure of your time. This will be the formal conclusion for today's internet seminar. Thank you.